Okay, so since the Wednesday is the tutorial day, I think I'm going to give a little bit of overview on what has to be done to solve radiative transfer problem in type 1A ejecta. And in the first part, I'll go a little bit more generally over that. And in the second part, I'm, in the sense of some applications of that, I'm going to present some stuff that I've been involved with. So I'm not going to talk about radiation hydrodynamics. If you want to know something about that, you have to ask Eric, I suppose. No?
Maybe.
So, so all I'm talking about is we have a given density structure from hydrodynamics of some sort, and we want to know what does the radiation do in that without interacting to the hydrodynamics. And the other thing is I'm only going to talk about UV photons to infrared and maybe some gammas, so no x-rays or something. So let's assume we have a nice observation of a supernova that has a light curve and maybe a nice spectral coverage over like a long extension of epochs. So the question is, what do we actually see here, and how do we interpret what we observe there? Or coming from the other end, we have an explosion model like those by Fritz Röpke. So there is the question, what would we see here if a supernova exploded like that? So to connect those things, all we need to do is solve a radiative transfer problem and then see if this has anything to do with that. Well, unfortunately, that's not that easy. And
is this a simulation or an artistic view?
This is a simulation. That's the density structure that you get from Okay. I'm not going to say very much about this. I think Wolfgang and Fritz are going to talk about these things. Okay. So back to the more basic, what do we actually need to solve? So that's the equation for radiative transfer, which can be derived from the Boltzmann equation for photons, essentially. And what that describes is how the radiation propagates in some matter that interacts with this radiation. So eta is the emissivity and chi is an opacity, so the radiation is going to be...
There's a pointer.
Oh, yeah. Thanks. So the general, this is, yeah, sort of the very general representation of this. And so the problem has, it basically depends on the position, which gives you three position coordinates. And then we have two direction coordinates and a wavelength and time dependence. So we have already a seven-dimensional problem to solve here. Well, in principle, if we know what eta and chi are doing, this problem can be solved. One can integrate this equation using the so-called source function, so eta over chi. And this gives the so-called formal solution or formal integral, which I've just written down here in plane parallel case for a better overview. So basically, that describes what the radiation, what radiation you get out on like some surface of a matter, slab of some sort, which depends essentially on what you put in on the other side, have some absorption, tau is the optical depth of the material, plus some emission terms in the source function, so whatever is contributed by the medium again in the emission. So if we know S, this is relatively easy to do. The problem is, in general, we don't know what S is, because eta and chi are functions of the radiation field itself. So we have they are basically determined by the microphysics of the atoms, ions, whatever is going on there, and that reacts to the radiation field, and also depends on the temperature of the gas. So that means that to solve all of that, we need an iteration procedure of some sort. And this is just give an overview. This is now already tuned to the 1A problem. in the sense we, as I said before, take the hydrodynamics as it comes from whatever explosion model, and that gives basically the density structure, velocity structure, the composition, and the mass of nickel 56. And so that is the input. From that, one can derive the deposition of gamma rays. So we need to do a gamma ray transport in some way. This is also something that can generally be done ahead of the actual calculation, and you just derive emission and thermalization, so heating terms that can be plugged into the whole thing. And then we have basically these three major blocks that need to be iterated. So this is the radiative transfer equation. This is now in spherical symmetry, which gives the radiation field that acts on the rate equation. So that includes all the microphysical processes that go on in the gas. So ionization and excitation, and the recombination and de-excitation processes. And that results in the occupation numbers, which then go here into the source function. And we need a temperature. For that, we need the energy equation, basically balancing the energy of the gas to get a gas temperature. So in principle, the model in that sense has three major thermal pools of energy. So we have the thermal kinetic energy of the gas, internal energy stored in the atoms and ions, and the energy of the radiation field. And the goal is to use all these processes and balance that in a way that we get an equilibrium state of some sort, or whatever we think is a suitable balance. Okay, now to the little bit more specific 1A problem. So far, this is basically the strategy what you need to solve a stellar atmosphere problem. 1As are a little bit more complicated in some respects than stellar atmospheres. So I'm just going through some basic properties that are important in that respect. First of all, as we saw in this explosion model, we may have to worry about a 3D structure. The whole thing expands with high velocity, so it is in principle a time-dependent problem. And if you really want to, you can also worry about special relativity, because the velocities are relatively high. In contrast to normal stellar atmospheres, we don't have any hydrogen or helium, so that means the spectra are dominated by iron group and intermediate mass elements, which has several consequences, one of them being we have a lot of atomic physics that needs to be worried about. Just to give you an impression, this is like the level diagrams for titanium 2 and silicon 2. And you can actually see what Paolo mentioned yesterday is that the iron group elements contribute significantly more lines to the problem than the intermediate mass elements. Note also this is, I think this is not even half of the ionization energy, so this is just where the model atom ends, so that continues up here with more lines. So this is all important to get that, to get a good database on atomic lines. And as Adi Pauldra usually points out, it is also important to get a high quality data. For the 1A problem, it's not only the quality that matters, it's actually also the quantity. So it's...
These lines are determined experimentally or with models, or a combination?
Well, in a sense, it's a combination of both, but these are atomic models, they're theoretical models that I think these things are run with superstructure. So this is the Iron Project and Keith Butler mostly. So, yes, the problem is with these elements, we don't have much of a continuum opacity. So that has been also mentioned before. Most of the opacity in 1A is contributed by the line spectral lines, and that's why I say also the quantity matters. You need all these or a lot of these lines, even though they may, like, you have a large majority of the lines are actually very weak, but you need them to get enough opacity. So that means the atmosphere is dominated by scattering, which scattering is an event where basically a photon gets absorbed in a line and gets re-emitted without coupling the radiation field to the thermal pool at all, which makes it very difficult to determine a temperature of this thermal pool, because only a minority of the process is actually coupled to the temperature at all. Because we don't have a real continuum, the continuum that we see in early time spectra of 1A supernova is called the pseudo-continuum, which is really this overlap of spectral lines. And another important consequence for that is it's not really possible to define a mean optical depth scale. Like in stellar atmosphere, we have a Rossland optical depth. It is some weighted mean of the wavelength dependent of the opacity. Because we have in a supernova, you can have the situation that, for example, in the UV, at a certain point in the ejector, you have an optical depth already like of 10 to the 5 or something, while in the infrared, the whole thing is more or less optically thin still. So it's very difficult to define anything useful in that sense that we have a mean optical depth. So one has to really look at the different frequencies and see what happens there. That basically means, yeah, I'm getting to that in a moment, that means that it's not really possible to define a photosphere in any way. So just the last 2 points, we have energy generation within the ejector, so there is no photosphere where we have the radiation actually emitted, but we really would have, well, we have to take that into account within the ejector. And of course, the gamma deposition also may lead to some non-thermal excitation of ions. With the high velocities and relatively low densities, this is intrinsically a non-LTE problem. So that means the level populations, ionization, and excitation rates cannot be determined by just using the Sacher-Boltzmann equation or something. And we have to really look at the different interaction of all the different processes and balance those processes to get the level populations. So with the photosphere, I'm showing here the comparison. So this is an O star somewhere somewhere near the photosphere. The different contribution from different kinds of opacity. So the green line is the continuum opacity, like the hydrogen ionization edges. And in this end, it's like the free opacity. Then added on are here the lines. So and that's what constitutes the so-called true opacity that actually does establish a connection between the radiation field and the thermal pool. And the blue line is the Thomson scattering, which does not couple to the thermal pool. So if you have an atmosphere that is dominated by Thomson scattering, you basically shine something out and it doesn't matter what temperature it is at. On the 1A, somewhere, well, deep in the ejector, sort of where you would place something like a photosphere, the picture is quite different. So we see the continuum opacity is several orders of magnitudes below the line opacity, and you can see how these lines really form the pseudo-continuum like distribution. And the other important thing is that the Thomson opacity in like beyond, say, 6,000 angstrom is actually the major contribution to the opacity in those atmospheres.
So that's actually, for that case, that is the Thomson opacity, given the free electron density.
Yeah.
That's not just a scale you're putting on there.
No.
I'm trying to understand it.
No, this is basically a model run, okay, and basically the output of that model.
So,
but of course, the densities are very different here.
No, I understand. So are you going to talk a little bit about all these overlapping lines and whether you get into the limit of sort of saturating all the oscillator strengths?
No, I don't think I'm going to go into the details there, but I don't know.
So if I ask the naive question, which is, you know, the back of the envelope, type 1A light curves, you know, you'd want to put in some kappa.
Right.
In the naive sense. So that number usually is 0.1 to 0.5 centimeters squared per gram.
Right.
Which feels like the number you'd expect if you've saturated all of the line strengths of the electrons.
Yeah.
Is that true, or is that just coincidence?
Well, I don't know. It's...
I think for just getting the light curve, it's a fair approximation.
Right.
For just getting light curve, it's a fair approximation.
Empirically, it works well, but question...
No, but yeah, but I'm asking, you've got the physics.
Right.
So what I'm asking is...
I haven't tried to derive, like, to compare that, really, but...
Right, so if you have all these overlapping lines because the velocity shifts, then if I remember right, but I've done this for 15 years, you end up getting a... You sort of end up getting all of the accumulated oscillator strengths because you integrate across all the lines, in which case you just get back that you've saturated all of the available electrons, and therefore you just get back something that ends up having the same dimensions as Thomson.
Right.
That's what I...
But this is what will enter eventually into the cycle of for the time being. We don't have that in yet. But we take constant opacity kind of thing.
Yeah.
But what's now being done is actually to put in all this information.
So maybe you're going to shut up. I'll just wait.
Okay.
I'm just really curious. I mean, is it a coincidence it ends up being that, or is it because you've saturated all the lines available? In which case, you don't need to know. You don't need, you know, at some point, you have to put all the lines in, but then if you saturate all the line strings, you just have to know how many electrons you have.
Right.
You know, neither is really correct.
So right.
You don't have a constant capacity because otherwise you're going to get different light functions. You don't saturate all the levels because you don't have enough things. So you're also going to have a variation about that value.
Yeah.
And that is enough to give you this problem. But yeah, you have such a fluctuation about that value.
And I mean, yes, a lot of lines are saturated, but not all of them.
But then the difference between things being iron and intermediate mass elements is that some of the, in the iron case, some of the electrons never become available to you, because they're so deeply bound, whereas in intermediate mass elements, they might become available to you. So the number of so if I ask how I change
the...
You're
only dealing with a couple of lines.
Yeah, that's...
Yeah.
Also, maybe you have less lines.
That's what I'm saying, is that so if I ask for the I ask how the continuum opacity changes once I've integrated over all the lines...
Well, the continuum opacity is
changing.
Yeah. No, sorry, the effect.
The lines that are available in the ions that are present.
Right.
But I guess what I'm saying is that if I had 2 gram, you know, a gram here of this and a gram here of intermediate mass elements, then my expectation is that because of the fewer available ions, that when I do the integrals, I'll get a smaller kappa.
Right.
Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Actually, they showed yesterday, but I didn't realize it.
But the effect is combined. So the intermediates already produce very little capacity. Just in the iron, you have all these huge capacity.
And you have a few characteristic lines, but...
We have no capacity.
Yeah.
Actually, we entered into this problem trying to get 3D light curves from the 3D models. And then you do the transport. And since the question is how you get the composition of your 3D structure. And in the past, we did it by following tracer particles that carry information about abundances and so on. And we have sent some 50,000 or 60,000 particles. But for 3D, that is not volume filling in a sense. And so what's happening is that you have some particles that are essentially iron, you have some other particles that are silicon, and you have some third particle kind that are carbon and oxygen, and they are scattered somewhere in the structure. Now you do your transport. And then your photons in Monte Carlo, by chance hit an iron particle, it has high capacities, or it comes through some structure that looks like a Swiss cheese with all these holes in the needles, and then you can be fooled getting light curves just the way it's done with the averages. And one has to be very careful because the capacities are so different.
Right.
It's highly non-trivial to have a light curve and no photo shape.
Well, but I can turn it around the other way. I can say the light curves look awfully much the same. Yeah. So it goes away, you're going to tell us why.
To some extent, that's true, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Another process that is important to set up this pseudo-continuum is the line scattering. And in particular, so we have photons that are basically being absorbed in one line and can be re-emitted in different other lines. So what this plot shows is the Monte Carlo simulation done with Paolo's code, where basically I've recorded the wavelength at which a photon packet was emitted originally at the photosphere or whatever you call it, and versus the wavelength that it emerged after the last interaction. So basically this diagonal line is the resonance scattering case, and everything that is above the diagonal is our photons that are transferred from being a blue photon out to redder wavelengths.
And this all based on single scatterings?
Or is it multiple
scatterings? No, these are possibly multiple scatterings. So it's always first to last interaction. So what we can see here is that a lot of photons are, the color or the gray shading information is basically where this last interaction happened. So the darker, the further out it happened. So what we can see here is that especially like in the redder part, this is like all the photons that come from a relatively blue spectrum are transferred into the red. But one can also see that the inverse process also happens. So, and something I'm going to mention later again in the application section. So we have actually quite a few photons that come from redder wavelength into bluer wavelengths. So this is an important property here. Well, there are some advantages compared to like stellar atmospheres in the supernova. And just what I'm mentioning here is we have large velocity gradients, so we can use the Sobolev theory, which basically allows you to transfer the non-local line transport into a local problem, because the interaction of a line is the spatial extension where a photon can interact with a line is only very narrow because of the large velocity gradients. And in the supernova, we have a homologous expansion, which makes the whole thing even easier because the gradient of the velocity is constant. So if we have this formula for the Sobolev optical depth, the velocity gradient basically falls out there. So that's useful. And the other thing is that because we don't have hydrogen or helium, which have very large energy separations between levels, the energy space for the levels in iron group elements is relatively almost continuously distributed, and so you can actually use LTE approximations, because the non-LTE effects become more serious if the energy separations of the energy levels are further separated. So these strong non-LTE effects in stellar atmospheres you mostly get because of hydrogen and helium having such large ionization and excitation energies. So that means within a single ionization stage, the distribution of level populations is almost LTE, or at least depending on which accuracy you want, you can use that approximation. And the other thing is what I said before, the temperature, the gas temperature is very hard to determine, but on the other hand, it also doesn't matter that much because it doesn't actually affect the radiation field too much. So that means that depending on how thoroughly you want to solve that problem, which essentially depends on how much time and funding you have to solve that problem, and how many observers sit there with a draft of a paper and want an interpretation of what they see, you can actually use approximations to the full problem that give some indication of what may be going on. So I'm going briefly through some of the approaches, and that has come up a few times already is this work by Dave Arnett, an analytic model of the light curve behavior, in which the major outcome of that, what is still used, is that you can roughly derive the mass of nickel 56 from the peak luminosity. So that's an important relationship, but of course it depends on the basic assumption that go into this analytic model, which is spheric symmetry, and that the nickel is nickel distribution is strongly peaked in the inner part of the distribution. And then I'm just going to mention here briefly the work by Pinto and Eastman, who have done a lot of analytic and semi-analytic work on all this interaction of different opacity and how you would have to treat the opacity and in these expanding atmospheres. Then another approach is by David Branch in his code SINO, which is a code that basically only parameterizes all the different properties of the atmosphere, in the sense that you say, you more or less, you set the optical depth in certain ions, and in that way it is very useful to determine what features in an observed spectrum may be coming from. But it is, I'm just adding this caution here, it is possible with this, because it is so highly parameterized, to get results that may be not that physical. So,
in what sense?
Because it doesn't actually, like, it's really, you more or less, you set the absorption for a certain line by setting these optical depth parameters. It doesn't necessarily mean that you can establish that in nature. So the temperature dependencies and are not really in there. So it really, you have to know if the result makes sense or not. That's,
you don't solve a transfer
equation at all. You basically, you only look at different optical depth scales for ions. So
no, it does solve the transfer equation. It doesn't solve the ionization or thermal balance problem.
Yeah.
There's a significant difference.
Yeah, okay.
So it may not be consistent.
Yeah, exactly. Just as a caution, I think. I mean, I think it is a very useful code for interpreting observed spectra, but one has to know what one's doing. That's the point. Okay. Then going to the different approaches of solving actually the full problem, and I'm just going to list a few here, and of course there's Phoenix, and Eddie Baron and Eric have worked on, and Peter Hausschild. So that basically is trying to solve the whole thing by solving the transfer equation. And I think Eric is going to probably talk a little bit more about that. I don't know. then a few other codes is the work by Adi Paulda that I've been involved in. It's also the same approach, trying to solve the coming, all, this is all coming from the stellar atmosphere problems, to solving the transfer equation as is. And then Luc Desart has recently done some work on that. And also Peter Höfli has a code that has different modules that solves different problems in a different way, depending what you want. So basic assumptions here is in the usual cases, an assumption that we can look at the atmosphere as a stationary problem, and the whole thing is spherically symmetric. I think Phoenix has, Eddie Baron had some paper on some 3D expansion of that problem, but I don't know what the status is of that. So it's spherically symmetric in general. The problem is if you have an observed spectrum and maybe a whole series of 15 spectra of one supernova, and you want to analyze that, that is only of limited use because it just runs forever. So I don't know what the current time is that you need to run Phoenix, but for Adi's code it's like a few hours, and Phoenix is probably longer. So if you have to run hundreds of models to find a nice fit to a spectrum, that's not very useful. However, it is of course the way to do the so-called forward modeling approach, in the sense of coming from an explosion model. You run your radiative transfer model once and see what do we get from that. Problem here is, of course, the explosion models are 3D now, so to keep pace with that, one has to really worry about extending that to 3D, or at least discuss how significant it is. Then just briefly mention some light curve codes by Blinnikov and the Japanese group, Iwamoto, and also Peter Höflich has done that, and that's really good radiation hydrodynamics, where it's not like for the full radiation hydrodynamic problem, time dependent, it's not usually possible to do the full non-LTE, and mostly the problem is you have to bin your wavelengths in, depending how much computer time you have, can only look at basically wavelength bands.
Why is the radiation hydrodynamics more important for the light curves than for the...
Well, I would...
Or it's just that since you don't have that much spectral resolution, you can take the radiation hydro into account.
No, for type 2 supernova, it is actually important to do the full radiation hydrodynamics, especially in the very early phase, because you can have more interaction of the radiation affecting the hydrodynamics. For the type 1 supernova, I think the effect is probably very minor, only in the very early phases where that may be important. But I think for if you don't have continuum opacity, that is...
So it's not necessary to the light curve calculation?
No, I mean, you can get decent results, but of course the first few minutes may not be right.
It's a question of time dependence.
Yeah.
So in the type 1s, the time dependence doesn't mean much. The type 2s, the combination is something.
Yeah.
It's also about where the codes come from.
Yeah, that's...
I mean, these codes are basically built on sort of the radiation hydro model with modest to low resolution. And the spectral codes are based on stellar atmospheres type numbers.
Mm-hmm. Right.
With thousands of wavelength points.
Right.
It's
and... And for the stellar atmosphere model, usually that is relatively unimportant, except that Adi Paldra, his code originally, the idea of that code was to derive the radiation force on the atmosphere. So he solves the radiation radiation transfer problem to derive the acceleration of the stellar wind by the radiation. But that part that I have been using is only concerned with the pure radiative transfer. Okay, the other way of solving that problem are Monte Carlo methods, and Paolo has already mentioned that. So instead of solving that transfer equation explicitly, you basically do a Monte Carlo experiment where you follow the photon packets as they propagate through the atmosphere and interact with the ejector. That has some significant advantages. Basically, you're not bound to any geometry because you don't need to put your transfer equation in weird coordinate systems. It's easy to run parallel on several machines because the photon packages are independent of each other. And you can set it up that the radiative energy is actually conserved throughout the atmosphere, or which is a problem solving the transfer equation, because there you need to balance the energy equation with, and the energy equation doesn't actually know that the radiation should be conserved in some way. So that needs to be iterated, and in the Monte Carlo approach you can put that in. That's an advantage. The problem is, if you really want to get a good spectrum from just the Monte Carlo output, it takes a lot of time because you need to run a lot of packages. There has been the approach by Leon, mostly developed by Leon Lucy, where he used the Sobolev escape probabilities to basically calculate the source function in a given grid cell, and then from that source function you can derive a spectrum just through this formal integral that I showed earlier. So that means you need significantly less packages than if you would want to establish the entire spectrum. And yeah, these methods have been used, and most prominently certainly Paolo Mazzali has a lot of work on that. And he has several codes, or spectrum code for early time spectra, light curve code with gray opacities, and a nebula spectrum code. And Kinomoto's group in Tokyo have been developing some generalization of those codes to 3D. Then Stuart Sim at MPA has developed a light curve code that is also based on these methods, that is currently still in gray opacity, but we're working on it. And of course, there's Dan Kaysen, who has the spectrum code with some time dependence effects, and also in 3D where he also can look at polarization effects. I think right now he's running that also in LTE because of computer time constraints. I get to that in a moment. So now I'm getting briefly to some applications of all of that. And so I've been using this early time spectra synthesis code by Paolo in the simple approach of saying stationary, spherically symmetric, using the W7 density structure as underlying explosion model. And here I'm assuming that we can actually define some sort of photosphere where we just emit all the radiation at this lower boundary and follow the photons through the atmosphere. So that's the simplification here. The model used as the stratified composition that has been put in by Matthias Steele. And so basically that means the model has the input of the composition, the density, the luminosity, the time after explosion, and the parameter of where this photosphere really sits. So I've been looking at UV spectra of 1As. So very briefly, why is it interesting? Well, the UV is the part that you actually see at high redshift. At high redshift, so you need to. It would be interesting to see what's going on there. And so far, there haven't been many observations because you obviously can't do that from the ground. So the UV of the of 1As is actually not that well studied. And the question is, and there have been claims that the 1As would be standard candles more in the UV than in other bands. And
Swift.
Swift.
I guess it seemed so obviously wrong. I must have fallen asleep when they said that.
It would be like her from Swift and saying, well, they look all the same for different kinds of points. They're around town.
Oh, well, they can be forgiven. They only got a few, and the precision's not too good. It's a, okay.
Okay. So Eric Lenz has published some work on the UV part. We have done some experiments with Phoenix in this direction as well. And of course, because the UV part is basically emitted the very outer part of the atmosphere, maybe there may be some hints on what the progenitor properties of that thing.
We're trying to get Richard Ellis to come and talk about a lot of the spectroscopy they have in the CFHT.
Yeah. You mean 2,500 angstroms or something like that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So we'll hear something about this in April.
Okay.
Hammering on
all. All right.
One thing that I think you should say about why UV is important is that the way the spectrum looks in the optical depends entirely on what it looks like in the medium.
Well, we saw.
Yes.
All the red photons.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so I have these two observations, HST observations, of 2001 EP and EH, both at about 29 days after the explosion. And, well, just looking at these spectra, it's already clear that the UV doesn't look very much alike in a sense here. Like, there are significant differences here already. So, all right. Sorry? Yes. So, been modeling these spectra and with this code, and basically got out these basic different luminosities of these two objects. But the actual goal of this little experiment was to use one of those spectra now and change the metal abundance in the outer part of this atmosphere, which is similar to the, what Eric has done with Phoenix at some point. I've done that a little bit more crudely in a sense by just changing the iron group abundance in the outer part, so above 13,000 kilometers per second, basically by hand just put in iron on the expense of oxygen. And the interesting thing here is, and I don't know if you can see this color coding, that in some wavelength bands, you get a depletion of the flux with higher metallicity, but in some bands you actually get also more flux out. And so the question was, how is there a in a sense a clean like correlation between the metallicity of the outer part and the flux that you get in the UV? And just to quantify this a little bit more, I've integrated those model fluxes in some of the HST filters, which I think is not what the instrument that has been observed with, but just to have some just to have some filter bands get a feeling for what the changes actually are. So the dotted line is actually the U-band filter. So what the result of that is that depending on which model we look at and depending which filters, you can get either really more flux in the UV. So this is the most extreme model. And this is all relative to my base model, so to speak. So relative to the original model. So these are not absolute scales in any way.
So the 29 days is after explosion or after?
That's after explosion, yes. That's after explosion.
So say again what the difference is between the upper panel and the lower panel.
These are two different models. So the upper panel, I've changed only the iron abundance. And in the lower panel, I've changed iron, nickel, and cobalt abundance, which, yeah, this is quite different results already. So it really depends significantly on what you do there.
So I'm trying to resurrect this. So Eric, you had a paper.
Yeah.
And then there was another paper, which I've forgotten who the authors were, but they had different punchlines about how the UV changed the metallicity. So it looks like you're also giving us two answers.
Yes, exactly. I think the crucial point is this is very difficult to really establish a clear correlation because you have a lot of effects that go into each other. And I think Eric's punchline in a sense was that the temperature of the outer part is affected by because you have basically two competing processes. One is the cooling by lines, and the other one is the line blanketing, which actually backscatters into the atmosphere and raises your temperature. So it's difficult to disentangle all these effects. We use here a relative crude approximation to the temperature. It's not that sensitive to that. And
I guess what I'm really bringing up, so if I was an observer and I wanted to go out and measure this, that had, in some sense, there's no prediction.
Could I ask another question? Can we go back one?
Yes.
So you only went to enhancement of the iron group, not the lower iron
right.
abundance. But that's what's interesting, is lower iron abundance, right? Because if you were thinking about looking at a high redshift, which have lower metallicity in general.
But your nucleosynthesis results are...
It's not going to be systematically higher than the local population.
Nucleosynthesis should be the same.
It might be the same, but it might be lower.
Well, who knows?
But it isn't going to be higher. So my question is.
Well, the question is.
Why go to higher?
Well, it could have some mixing.
Yeah, exactly.
So, well, that could be.
What he's after, because he was talking about a couple of decks, so it's not really. Effect of 2 effect, effect of 10, or effect of 10, effect of 15.
This is really just putting that in.
At the photosphere at 13,000 kilometers.
The photosphere is deeper here. The photosphere is 6,000.
Wait a minute. I'm just trying to understand where you think the iron. You think this iron was made in this explosion or not?
It's made. Because
Okay, so here it is, 13,000
kilometers. No, sorry. He's taking the data at day 29.
Yeah.
At that time, the supernova is almost in the phase of it.
Well, I wouldn't say that, but
quite a bit of this, the entire
we call 10 days after maximum.
The photosphere is at 6,000 about.
So it's after explosion.
Yes.
Okay, that's what he said. The line foliar region is about 5,000, 6,000.
Yes. So this is really above what you would call a photosphere.
So it is in the non-symmetric
yeah. region. Right.
But it certainly would be interesting to drop those as well. I mean, what's the problem with doing that?
You can go down. No, there is none. You can do that. Yeah. I haven't done it, but we can do that.
But if you want to do what Bob suggests, you have to go to an earlier.
Right. Yeah, yes.
And that's doable as well. It's interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I understand. You pick this to match. Observation.
We don't have UV
right.
spectrum. Yeah, yeah, that was.
But in 92A, we had, you know, we had.
Yeah, 92A is the same. You can control the spectra on day 29. Then you have already iron. We had already iron.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Iron in the spectrum.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like Nancy Allen. It's 65.
That's why we tried
to get early UHC data, and unfortunately
all instruments are being failed.
Yes.
Okay. So I guess the conclusion from this study is that the UV part is to a large fraction actually formed by this inverse scattering effect that I've shown previously here. So we have all these lines that really set up the pseudo-continuum, and this process, and that's the purpose of this plot, is really shows that this is an important process for the formation of the UV. So, and I would mention also the statement that was also made by Pinter and Eastman, that the spectral properties, and that applies especially to the UV where we're dominated by a lot of lines, really depend on the distribution of lines and not on some thermal whatever properties of normal thermal atmosphere in some way. So it really depends, the shape of the spectrum depends on where basically the number densities of lines in frequency space change. Okay, so important outcome is that UV flux is relatively sensitive to the physical conditions. So, and the naive picture of putting more metallicity on the outside would give you less flux because you have more absorption in this region may not be true. Really depends. So the other application that I'm briefly going into it, and just to advertise that, because that is work that has been mostly done by Stuart Sim at MPA, and he's going to be at the conference and present that in some way. I don't know if he's giving a talk or a poster. So I'm just advertising that here. So that was concerned with 3D light curves from some off-center ignition supernova models that Fritz Röpke has been calculating. So the idea why that is interesting is first of all, there's some observational evidence that we have some intrinsic scatter of supernova that needs to be explained, and also we have some supernova that completely are off the scale, and also there have been some observations of polarization in 1As. Then there are theoretical aspects where the ignition process, which I think Wolfgang will probably talk about more, is very uncertain, and possibly detonation scenarios of various kinds that I will go into here. Stuart's light curve code is this 4-3D code. That also uses these Monte Carlo estimator methods. The gamma transport and energy deposition by gamma rays is actually done as the full transport, but so far the optical photons are only treated in this composition dependent but constant gray opacity that Paolo has essentially used. So this is certainly work in progress, and this is just the first step. So Stuart has run a bunch of toy models where he studied all these viewing angle effects, and then applied the whole thing to a real explosion model by Fritz Röpke. And just to show that here, this is, I think Fritz is probably going to talk about that some more maybe. And So this is an explosion model that where the ignition happened somewhere off center in the outer, or like in kind of a drop shaped manner, and then you got this explosion that develops really off center. So this plot shows basically a cut through the ejector at the end, and the white stuff is the iron group elements, and you can see that it's offset from the center of mass of that thing. So Stuart has run a bunch of 100 models with different viewing angles. So this shows the peak luminosity of those models as a function of the cosine of between the axis where the offset of the nickel distribution was and the viewing angle. And this is basically the rotation in the phi direction. Are like the different points here. So what you can see is that in the direction where the offset of the nickel distribution is strongest, you get the brightest light curve, and then it drops here. And the important part here is that the minimum is actually like not exactly the opposite direction, which is can be seen here in these. Well, so it's basically in this direction where the minimum is.
Is there a lot of burnt CO in this case?
Yes, there is.
So the nebular phase would be a problem for these models?
Probably.
When you view them from...
It doesn't matter, nebular phase.
But
it should be a little more precise about the model.
Yeah.
So Stu has on toy models.
Yes.
Kind of motivated by what Fritz off-center models look like. So all this is points here on this arc were computed, taking a certain amount of nickel and displacing it in velocity space.
Right.
And then you can, of course, run hundreds of models to see how certain displacements in velocity space change into or can be converted into luminosity. And then looking at aspect angles and all that. So the full 3D models are. At the moment, well, of course, we have computed all the light curves for a full 3D model. This was more motivated to get the offset and velocities of the nickel.
Right.
But here you're talking about
this is,
integrated luminosity.
Yes, this is bolometric luminosity. We have only gray opacities at this point. So this is just the bolometric.
How big the effects are.
Right. And the answer is 20%, so they're big enough.
Yeah,
right.
It's a paper that's been submitted to monthly notices, and still we haven't received the reference report yet, which I sent off 2 weeks ago.
So, yes, this is really just a first basic test of what you would see, and of course, it requires some more work in that direction.
Right. And of course, a more delicate test would be the spectroscopic.
Yes, absolutely.
I understand that.
No, this is really just a first,
I mean, exactly. Tom sitting next to you has spectrum colors for 100 and some number of
supernovae,
if there was some obvious correlation between excess luminosity and spectroscopic properties, I think we would begin to know it by now. Mm-hmm. So the interesting thing would be to limit that.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So. Yeah.
So what exactly comes with spreading those, for given data?
Here? What do you mean?
What accounts for the spread? Is it just variation?
Just the variation of viewing angle and how much material of different composition you have between.
So that's what for a given data.
That's, mm-hmm. Yes. So, and this is really a very first step in a sense. So the interesting outcome of this model is actually that this shows the probability, the accumulated probability distribution of seeing a certain luminosity, like by randomly picking some viewing angle. And what we see here is that it's actually not symmetric about the mean. So that means that the probability of seeing a somewhat fainter end supernova maybe is a little bit larger than seeing one on the larger, on the brighter side. So, but of course, this is all based on one single model, the one single explosion model. And we can do the exercise in putting that in, just comparing that to the spread that you get in a Hubble diagram. We used here the data from Max's work, because we have to compare it to something that is close to bolometric in some way. And I guess the outcome is really that the spread of this relation can, in principle, be is consistent with this model. So you cannot say this model has properties that are already ruled out by the dispersion about the mean in the Hubble diagram.
Polarization might be a good way
of testing. Yeah.
Polarization accurate enough in the Hubble flow.
Right. So I guess that these are the main conclusions for that, and more details will probably be given by Stuart on when he's here for the conference. So, but the main conclusion is one could think of having such off-center ignited models that could contribute to the population of 1As in some way. It's probably not very likely that one can correct that with the same methods like the Phillips relation. And potentially we can, this could lead to an observational bias in some way. But certainly this is just the first step and needs further consideration. Thank you.
Can we go back to the UV spectra? You showed the two observations and you said, look at these two things you said. These look different.
Yeah, they do.
And I was wondering if you plotted them, they all look very different, right?
Oh, they do look different.
Okay.
Like, but also the optical part looks different.
Same lines. The point is, it's the same lines.
This is really. This is
down in the UV, please.
In the UV.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
It's all the inset, right? It's got the inset.
Right. It's all the same lines.
Right.
So I didn't understand why you said those are so different in the UV.
Well, just this part.
Well, from 4,000 down.
Yeah, from 4,000 down.
Yeah. If that's what I would call the UV sort of.
Right. And you have this peak, and that compares to this peak. Yeah.
They're all the same features.
Right, but different.
Widths, because it's atomic physics. Right?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So I would conclude from that there's very little to be learned. Because it's set by atomic physics, you know, where the lines are in
yes.
the spectrum of iron 2, 3, and that's it.
Well, the question what you learn from the UV is it is difficult because you have this overlap of all these lines. You can't separate those lines. And you have
it's
also.
It's going to be iron and cobalt.
Oh, yeah.
And it's always going to be the same, sort of. Right? And that's all there is.
Yeah, and you have only a very small fraction of the flux in the UV at all. So there's not very much light there at all. So
So if you looked earlier,
but you have to go much earlier.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
You have to go much earlier. So you can pass flux.
Right. Because, you know, that looks like 87A or anything else.
Oh, yeah.
But you could use it as a tool in
the Right.
Couldn't you use it as a tool in the sense that if you know exactly how the UV looks like, for supernova where the extinction is very uncertain, you can use that as a diagnostic.
Now, the thing you don't know is the flux level. The thing you do know is the shape of the lines. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, but you don't have pronounced lines. That's, I mean, it's not like a star where you can look at the details of certain lines.
No, I agree. Yeah. I understand. Absolutely.
Can I ask what's going on between 6 and 8,000 angstroms?
Yes. that's basically a consequence of this photospheric approximation. So, in this region, the opacity is dominated by the Thomson scattering, and that's where you see the assumption of a black body continuum underneath somewhere that you see through here.
The red.
That adds basically flux that in nature is not there, because in nature you don't have this flux there because you don't have thermalization.
So that's why it's always over.
That's why it's always over predicting that. Yeah.
So the failure of the model.
Right.
The failure of the star. The star did not read the paper.
Yes.
Very few do. Yeah, right.
Doug's experience. Can I, just realized, can I switch Wolfgang Eric in terms of the temporal ordering? Is that okay this week? Sorry, I just had the last bureaucratic detail. Wolfgang, can I put you on Thursday and Eric on Wednesday? Since Eric's going to be more...
Could be, no problem.
Okay, fine. Thanks.